it was a moment that was seared into my soul, so much so that I have not forgotten it from the moment it happened. So I was brand new to the New York Daily News editorial board. So I was about 25, 26 years old. And I had pitched the idea of interviewing Reverend Jackson about something related to New York City schools and guns. Reverend Jackson said yes to the interview. So we set up a time and he said, well, my schedule's really busy. I'm coming through New York. Why don't we do it at LaGuardia? And so I was like, great. I'm meeting Reverend Jackson. So I put on my best suit. And it was this brand new suit that I bought. It was a Christian Dior, double-breasted, with a chalk stripe.
Only way Jonathan Capehart's going to attire himself, trust me.
You know, I was just like, I'm about to meet history, so I need to look right. So I get dressed. I'm so nervous that I'm going to miss him, that I get to LaGuardia an hour early. And for my time at the Today Show, I knew there were conference rooms at the Eastern Shuttle or Delta Shuttle, whatever it was, you know, in 93. And so I get there, I get us a room, and now I'm waiting at the gate. Swipe lands. There's nobody. And then I realize, wait, folks can deplane out the back. Let me go and look. And that's when I saw him walking across the tarmac to baggage. So I ran to baggage. And who's with him but the Reverend Al Sharpton?
Mm-hmm.
And so Reverend Al Sharpton, I was like, oh, man, I don't want to. This guy, this is when Reverend Al and I, this is my first time meeting him. So we get up to the conference room, we sit down, and Reverend Sharpton says, this is what I heard. Wakazala. And I said, excuse me? And he said, Wakazala. This is what it sounds like. And I'm trying to decipher. So I say, I think in my head, he's asking me, what kind of suit is that? So I said, oh, this is my first suit that I bought since graduation. It's a Christian Dior, double-breasted, I did the whole thing. And then that's when I look up and I see him laughing, and he just looks at me and says in the clearest articulated English, I asked you, what college did you go to? And I just wanted to self-immolate. I died. I just, you know, if I could just go into the void, or Homer Simpson my way out of that room, into the hedges. And I just looked and I said, oh, I went to Carleton College. And then he and Reverend Jackson sort of ping pong. I went to the College of Pierre Cardin. Well, I went to the College of Yves Saint Laurent. And I was just like, ha ha, very funny. Let's get started. I've never forgotten that. I was so embarrassed.
But it just tells you, you know, the framing of that is important on a number of levels, because it says a lot about you as a young man trying to figure out the spaces and get it right, and how sort of the established order of things comes across. I mean, in other words, it just wasn't very clear what he said. I mean, if the man was speaking the King's English in a way you understood it at the time, you would have answered the question.
Right.
But it is so funny, though, because what's interesting about that moment is the arc it would later have with the Apollo Theater and your encounters with Reverend Sharpton,
mm-hmm.
Which ultimately the writing that you did about the Apollo and that period in New York got you the Pulitzer.
Mm-hmm.
And so that arc is an important one in how I read through the book. Those things that took place at a certain time would then come back in another time, in a different way, in a different shape, a different form. But there would be some connection to you, I mean, for you in terms of your path, your growth, and the impact that it would have on you, and you would ultimately have on the business you chose. Mm-hmm. What was that part of the journey like when you were having that second moment with Al Sharpton, where he pulls you aside and says he wants to talk to you about something you've written or about him and the failure of leadership, right? To deal with the problem. Did you remember that moment you just talked about, or had that just faded away into something else?
Oh, no. That was an indelible moment. I mean, that moment just was seared into my soul. And that began to that initially defined my relationship with Sharpton. We were like this for years. He hated the editorial and column I ran as a result of that meeting. And he, you know, I remember my editor calling me into his office because Reverend Sharpton was on the phone and he had him on speaker. And all you could hear was, I told Capers. He wouldn't even pronounce my name correctly. It was right. Capers. So fast forward. So then after that, we met up again. We were both on Geraldo Rivera Live when he had a show on CNBC, the night of the Million Man March. And it was that interview. Again, we were like this. And he, again, mispronounced my name, much to the consternation of my mother. My mother then told me, tell Al Sharpton to pronounce your name correctly. Years later, when Rev and I became friendly, this is an aside, I told him what my mother said, and he laughed, and he said, well, you know, that's a tactic. By mispronouncing your name, I belittle you to the audience. And so by the time you get to speak, you have been belittled in their eyes because—
Very, very Trumpian. Yeah. Very Trumpian.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I was like, oh.
Early Trump.
If you ever watched Rev's show on MSNBC and I'm on the show, you notice he says my name very clearly because he doesn't want my mom mad at him. But to get back, so when we're doing the Apollo, again, we are still like this. So that first initial thing was 93. We're right. Now at 1998. Right. And so we're doing the Apollo Theater editorials. He's already held a community forum where they bashed the hell out of the New York Daily News, saying things like it's the white media establishment coming after us in Harlem, which I knew was going to be, you know, part of the tactic to defend the leadership of the Apollo. And we ran a few of the editorials. I went on New York one. And then I get a phone call from Reverend Sharpton. They said, we need to meet. And I said, we? You mean we, the editorial board, or we, meaning you and me? And he said, no, just the two of us. I said, great. I meet him at what was then the Stage Deli on 7th Avenue.
Right.
And he comes in and, you know, we get right down to it. And he asks me, why are you doing this? And I said, and he said, because there's a rumor that you're doing this at the behest of Governor George Pataki, who was the Republican right. governor at the time, to, for lack of a better description, dirty up then Congressman Charlie Rangel, because he was on his way to becoming, if the Democrats retook the majority, chair of the very powerful House Ways and Means Committee. And I looked at Reverend Sharpton, and I said, Reverend Sharpton, that's not true. This has nothing to do with the governor. This has nothing to do with any battle that they might be having. This has everything to do with saving the Apollo. And I walked him through why we were doing it, our tour, what we saw. And I said, Reb, you've been to the theater. You know it's a dump. We're trying to save the theater. And we were just, you know, Stage Deli at the time was just above Times Square, right. blocks from Times Square. And that was when The Lion King had opened up on Broadway and, you know, was part of the revitalized Broadway. And I said, Rev, why shouldn't the Apollo Theater be as successful as all these revamped theaters down on Broadway? The Lion King is making money hand over fist. Meanwhile, the Apollo Theater is sitting dark 5 to 6 nights a week. Where's the why isn't the chairman, he eventually became chairman, but right. why shouldn't Charlie Rangel, dean of the congressional delegation, best friends with still President Clinton at the time, why couldn't he get an earmark? Why couldn't he use his power to help the
thing? Right.
And I just want to use this opportunity right now because the late, great Charlie Rangel, Chairman Rangel, passed away yesterday on the 26th of May. And, you know, he was another person who, you know, we battled over the Apollo Theater. We battled so much that when I went to the state dinner for the South African president and took my mother as my date.
Right.
He and I got into it in the tent on the South Lawn. I don't write about this in the book, but we got into it on the South Lawn, and I had my mother on my side, and he had his wife, Alma, on the other side, and she jumped in and said, you know, now, this is not the place. But that began the slow repair of the relationship to the point when I moved to Washington, I talked to the congressman many times about many things when I got to the Washington Post. And so back to the story with Reb, I tell him the whole thing and he looked at me and he said, I believe you. And then said, you know, listen, anytime you want to find out what's going on, call me. And if I know something, I will tell you, and I won't say anything about this again. And Rev kept his word. He never said anything about the Apollo Theater publicly again. And that began our relationship, very good relationship that's now more than 25 years old.
So you wrote in that section of the book something that I in my political life, particularly as a young Black conservative Republican working in the District of Columbia where I grew up, or in the state of Maryland where I'd become an elected official. You wrote a passage that I thought really summed up one of the biggest problems. And really to me, and I don't want to project anything onto the relationship or certainly anything onto Rev, because Rev and I have, you know, like you, started out at political polar opposites. And, you know, we work together very well now and love the Rev. But you wrote, quote, I came to learn how that custom of respect and deference, which is something that is very prominent in the Black community, that you have respect and deference for your elders, right? And so therefore you give them a large swath of land from which to operate, large space. You went on, could serve as a cloak against accountability, allowing people to say or do nothing even when things are wrong. And that is so profoundly true, that the individuals in leadership at that time who had responsibility for that theater at that time and for the conditions in Harlem at that time, who represented those districts and those communities at that time, seemingly were okay with the status quo. And so what you did by leveling up the conversation and exposing what was happening or not happening and writing about that and articulating that struck a nerve. Mm-hmm. And that, I think that is what is profoundly important. And for you in particular, given your journey, this idea of holding people accountable for what they do, telling the story and the untold stories that people should know, would really kind of, I think, at least my sense in reading from there on, Jonathan, it really kind of defined how you would continue to do your work. You know, making the move to Bloomberg after that was a big deal, right? Because you didn't think you could do. This is finance. What the hell I know about finance? I'm not writing about finance, right?
Right.
But you found a voice there. You found that even in that space, in a space that was at least perceptually far afield from where you were and what you were doing, you could land and tell a story.
Right. Well, there are two pieces to this. So in terms of holding folks accountable, I mean, in some ways you could say I was and remain very naive. I actually think that people in positions of leadership should be held accountable, especially people in positions of public trust.
Right.
And, you know, understanding and realizing that on the one hand, I understand why people will rally around someone who they feel is under attack unfairly by some outside community, because that's what they always do. But then if, you know, here I am, a Black journalist, and I see something happening that is to the detriment of a Black institution, well, wait, what? You want me to stay silent because the chair of the board is the dean of the congressional delegation and is a representative of Harlem, and anything bad would reflect poorly, not just on him, but on the community, and therefore we must protect him. I'm sorry, no.
Right.
No, that's just not how this works or how this should work. And so, you know, I took a lot of heat from people who, you know, on the one hand, growing up, I was too Black, and now suddenly I'm not Black enough,
right?
Because I have the temerity to write stuff trying to hold elected officials accountable. But, you know, naive or not, I had the presence of mind to say to my editor, we should hold publication of these editorials because you're planning on running them when I'm out of town. And I know the moment these hit, they're going to say the white Daily News is coming for, you know, the black leadership of Harlem. And I wanted to be in a position that the editorials run, and then I go on New York One as the visual, like, nope, this has nothing to do with the way they're casting it. It has everything to do with protecting a Harlem landmark. And I'm really happy, you know, the Apollo Theater is thriving now. Yeah. It is thriving with fantastic leadership, a fantastic board. So I'm happy we did it.
Until next time, y'all, take care of yourselves. Remember what I always tell you, don't play with stupid.